could happily talk to you about, there is at least one important food writer from that time, Athenaeus, voluminous and completely untrustworthy writings about food as he knew about it, and it's something maybe you were interested in, and I encourage you to pursue that at another time in the library right near here. But what happened to me was that like many people in my era, went to spend a summer as an unbathed student in Europe, and became interested without even realizing that it had, I had become a passionate, I don't want to say gourmet, someone interested in food. I was supposed to be learning French in Paris, and maybe I did learn a little, and eating in cheap restaurants, and I became fascinated in a kind of, I now see in a kind of intellectual way about it, trying to catalog all the things I was eating and learn the words for foods and to figure out what categories they were. Anyway, I ate in a lot of restaurants. I came back. I ended up somewhat later as a foreign correspondent for Newsweek, which I was also unqualified to be. I got there because they thought I had been a summer intern, and they wanted to hire me to work in their cultural sections. But a job opened up in the Paris bureau because this extremely qualified correspondent, who was a bicultural French, he was French, but he had spent World War II in Britain, so he spoke French with an English accent and English with a French accent, and he was just perfect. He was a great reporter, and unfortunately, he did something very unwise, which was to pretend that it was the dawn of the little cassette audio recorder, and he had done an interview with someone who had had a minor role in a big political scandal in Paris, which did have a restaurant connection. It's not a Moroccan dissident named Ben Barka was abducted from the terrace of the Brasserie Leap on the Boulevard Saint-Germain and never heard from again. And the scandal then began affecting all aspects of French government, and there was a film producer that Ed Baer, my colleague, my predecessor, he did an interview with him, and the next day the man was assassinated. Now this interview was published, and the claim was made that every quotation in it was part of a recording made on this Philips recorder, which I myself came to use when I got to the bureau, and it failed, as they always did. Battery failed, there would be a tangle in the tape again. Anyway, he said it was that, but in fact he had taken subsidiary notes, so the article was accurate, but he didn't want to appear in the trial where the abductors were tried in absentia. So he got himself transferred to Hong Kong, and they suddenly saw they could send me to Paris, so I went to Paris. I had nothing to do for 2 years there because there were four people in a bureau that one person could have handled. I was the youngest. They all cut me out of everything. So all I had was an expense account. And I did assiduously make use of that. And I think there's no one, or very almost no one in this room, I think nobody, who would have been an active diner out in Paris in 1966. And if there, at any rate, the story was that, like the country itself, there was a kind of lack of action going on. Charles de Gaulle was in his second time running the country, and he, it was a kind of benign totalitarian state, and a well-run totalitarian state doesn't have really any news. So if you're a reporter, and of course you have no access as an American reporter in a time of notable hostility to Americans or contempt, there was really nothing for anyone to do, certainly not for the fourth person in the bureau, known in French as the Benjamin, the Benjamin of the bureau, as the youngest of Joseph's brothers. And so I had all this time, and I pursued it, and I discovered that what I was really doing was more of this same taxonomy of classic French food. And what we all felt at the time, without, I didn't so much as say it to myself, but it was clear that we were all involved in eating food that represented on its surface a timeless, unchanging, classic reality of French gastronomy. Now this wasn't, of course, not true. Things had changed, they were changing all the time, but the idea of innovation was not part of the scene. You weren't expecting to have anything that no one had ever eaten before. You would go to a great restaurant and there would be a minor personalization of the dish, perhaps, but it was an exercise in museum cooking, unavowed, but that's what it was. And as a result, and this was pervasive throughout the world. I mean, when I came back to New York, I found the same thing in all kinds of restaurants, that you were getting more or less expert versions of things that were already in cookbooks that people knew about, and that's what you expected, is what you wanted. What attracted me to the field in the first place, because of my, I was clearly a cultural conservative because I was in classics. So, I wasn't reading experimental literature. I was, reading Homer. So, which may have been improvised before it was written down, but by the time I got to it, it was a century. We weren't looking for a new variation on the Iliad. The same thing was true in the food. And this produced, when I finally became a restaurant critic, which happened in a way that was so unexpected that it took my breath away. For a man who worked next to me had a really serious, crippling writer's block at Newsweek, where I had become a cultural writer after I came back from France. And he had worked at the New York Times before he got to Newsweek and became completely non-functional. But he kept up his contacts, and he knew that the great Craig Claiborne, who kind of invented modern restaurant criticism in American newspapers in the 60s at the New York Times, was leaving the paper, and there was this opening which was advertised by the Newspaper Guild, and so my friend Alex said, "You should really apply for that job. You're so obsessed with food," which I was, in a way that a lot of people who cook a little and had read Julia Child and been abroad a little bit, I was like that. But I was certainly not, some kind of big time food writer, even in my own wildest imagination. It never occurred to me. Anyway, I laughed at him, and then he went and found another colleague who was a personal friend of the, what was then called the woman's editor of the New York Times, Charlotte Curtis, who was a great character and someone. When I found out that she wanted to talk to me, I still thought this was a ridiculous idea of becoming a really important exposed food critic, a restaurant critic of the New York Times. And I thought, I'd like to meet Charlotte Curtis, who wrote these acerbic wedding announcements making fun of debutantes who were getting married in pretentious ways around the city. And so I met her, and we had lunch at the old Cote Basque, which was a short walk from my office on Madison Avenue. And the way they worked then was, these restaurants were all in a mold created by a real monster named Henri Soulet, who had come to New York for the World's Fair in, I think, 39, and had opened at the fairgrounds something called the French Pavilion that he later transformed into a full-time restaurant in Manhattan called Le Pavillon. And it was, for its day, hands down the most admired, revered restaurant in America. And the fact that he was a horrible snob and an arguable anti-Semite didn't change the fact that he reigned supreme over this little world. And his idea was that seating really mattered. And the food was something of a fraud. Not that it wasn't good, but that it represented a very safe menu he had invented at the World's Fair and then transferred, and it became the model for the three or four or five rivals that sprang up around him. One of them was the Côte Basque, which he created as a kind of second outlet, a somewhat sportier version of the Pavillon, and he gave it to his mistress, a woman called Henriette Spalter, who was known in the trade as Madame Pipi, because she had been the women's room, the ladies' room attendant at the Pavillon. And there was her son Albert was also part of it. Anyway, the Côte Basque continued this incredible snobbery about seating. And there were maps in Town and Country magazine of where you wanted to sit in these restaurants. And there was always as close to the door as possible so that more people would see you when they came in. And so I'm sitting with Charlotte Curtis at the door of the Côte Basque, in the table, you know, the seats perilous. And people all through this restaurant are wondering who, because they recognized her, wondering who is this young man with Miss Curtis? And, you know, there was some woman in a turban, a Romanian dowager, sent us a bottle of wine. And the gossip columnist, Leonard Lyons, came over. You know, he would make the rounds of restaurants to see who was at lunch and get quotes from them. And he, you know, tried to get her to say who I was and what was going on. And she was very cagey. Anyway, we left. And, the other thing was that way in the back, I could see Catherine Graham, the owner of the Washington Post, or the head of the Washington Post Company, which owned Newsweek, was having lunch with the executive editor of Newsweek, my ultimate boss, and I'm sitting at a much better table. So we go back, and eventually she said, you know, you could have this job if you wanted. We want to get someone no one's heard of before and kind of create a new kind of critic. And but you've never written about food before, so maybe you would be willing to do three tryout pieces, and then we could show them to the managing editor. If you do okay, then we'll hire you, and if you don't, we'll pay you for them anyway. We're not, and they won't. We'll keep it very quiet, so you can hold on to your job at Newsweek. So I thought, this is great. You know, they'll pay me to do all this stuff, and I can eat in restaurants on them. So I did it, and then the other person they were thinking of hiring dropped dead while jogging in Central Park. And so they offered me the job. And so I went there, Charlotte Curtis and I and Craig Claiborne had lunch on my first day at work in the New York Times cafeteria, a place which A.J. Liebling, the New Yorker writer who I later did a biography of, he said that he made this really great comparison of it. He said, you know, there's a certain kind of writing which is as flavorless as the food in the New York Times cafeteria. And so, you know, this is not a place where fine distinctions about food service were logically made, but Craig, as he sat down, he put this soup spoon to his lips, and he looked at us, as though it was the most normal thing in the world, and he said, there's too much bay leaf in this puree mango. And do you know what, if you ever had puree mango? See, it's completely out of fashion now. It was something that, in elementary school cafeterias, it's a puree of peas and tomatoes with a stock and maybe some milk in it, you know, and seasoned somewhat aggressively. That's the Mongolian part, I guess. But but it was something that was so, you know, old, creaky, and uninteresting all by itself. You know, that this man, you know, who had really made a big reputation, changed the way that that people all over the place were writing about. I mean, he was the emblem of the restaurant critic, and he just couldn't help himself. You know, because he was making these kinds of distinctions. And here's my real point here is not that he was foolish, because he was not. He was really a genius of communicating sophisticated information to a general audience about food in a newspaper. And but it was also, you know, as say, a déformation professionnelle. I mean, he couldn't stop. And even something as routine and boring as a cafeteria version of Puree Mongole, which was already 50 years out of fashion, you know, would occur to him to say that, you know, was very amusing. But it really meant something. And here's my point. You know, the kinds of reviews that he wrote and that his that anyone would do at that time. There was a man in Paris, in Le Monde, whose pseudonym was La Reynière, and he was the same, and it was true. Clementine Paddleford, you know about Clem Paddleford, of course, the food critic for Parade magazine, the Roto insert, the color magazine that was inserted in the Detroit Free Press, I think, that I read as a child. You know, all these people, what they did, they'd assume that what you really wanted to know about a restaurant, apart from details of service or decor, which they spent very little time on, was how the particular dish they ate stacked up against some classic Platonic notion of that dish. So, you know, let's say, you know, some Blanquette de Veau, some French classic of the past that was still a fixture in France and elsewhere of restaurant cooking and home cooking. And they would tell you how that Blanquette de Veau veal stew would match up against the ideal. And they'd say, this one, you know, a little more bay leaf, that kind of thing. And or came to the table cold, or the meat was stringy, things like that. And so you get the 800 words that Craig and later I had to talk about restaurant meals, basically you didn't have any more time once you were done saying the meat was stringy and there were three desserts and only one of them is worth ordering because the flan is a granular, you know? And once you knew that was a bad thing, the granular flan, then you knew to say that. So but this kind of remark, it's not that people, you know, were unimaginative. It was the logical, the inevitable way of discussing food in a review column at a time when you were not at all expecting to be surprised. The kind of jazz-like improvisation that could occur, you know, in the setting we have today, where you got everything is up for grabs, was just inconceivable. And in any kind of restaurant, I mean, nobody was thinking that, a few things were kind of modern. Fettuccine Alfredo had, I mean, that you could put a date on when somebody called Alfredo in Rome. I ate in that restaurant when I was an undergraduate. And they would, it was a dish that had been kind of concocted, but it was a very minor variation on classic pasta presentation. I mean, they did use a gold fork, and it was a slightly different recipe, but that counted as innovation. So in that world, if you were going to review restaurants, what people wanted to know was, did these things whose names they all knew, anybody really serious about food would have known about almost all these dishes, and have eaten them before, and if you're reviewing a restaurant, they wanted to know, did they do a good job? And it was a little bit, you know, the story about the new inmate in the penitentiary, and he comes in, and at late at night, he hears the lights are out, and someone says, 18, and then there's all this laughter, and then a little while later, someone says, 27, more laughter. In the morning, you know, during the exercise, he asks another prisoner, he said, what was all that about last night? He said, well, you know, we're all here for so long, and we all know the jokes, so it's not worth telling them. They each have a number. And then, you know, you can learn them and go to the prison library, and there's a big joke, a summary where all the jokes are written down, and you memorize them, and then you can be a popular joke teller, too. So he spends all his free time memorizing these jokes, and he goes back, and finally he's ready. And one night, he waits for a break in the hilarity, and he says, 31, total silence. And 75. Total silence. Says to his cellmate, "What's the matter? Why aren't they laughing? I've been there and memorized those stories." He said, "Yeah, but you just didn't tell them right." And my feeling was that it was a similar kind of close, I mean, looking back on it, I certainly didn't have this perception at the time, that you were in this kind of world where it was a closed circuit. And in fact, there was a book that you could look at called the Repertoire de la Cuisine, the Repertoire of the Kitchen, published by two men named Gringoire and Saulnier. It's still in print. It's even translated into English. I saw it on Amazon this week. And it doesn't have recipes. It just has the classic menu names of every dish and every garnish in what was the accepted classic repertoire of an era that basically coincided with the career of the great chef Escoffier, who codified a lot of this in one really important book published before World War II. And so you look up, and that's why on menus of that day, you'd see something, you know, it would say Côte de Boeuf Metternich. And you could look it up in Gringoire and Saulnier, and it would tell you, all, you know, seven, in very, very terse language that a chef would understand, the seven things that were necessary, the garnishes, the vegetables that went with it, and the platter that it all sat on, what that looked like. And so it was like those joke books. And if you knew what was going on, I used to have a bartender's guide like that, you know, that I would have with me, and I would amaze dates by you know, I'd consult it in the men's room and come out and order a drink with a preposterous name that they would think I was making up called. I would say, I'd like a Fluffy Ruffles, I would say. There really is such a drink. And the waiter would scratch his head. I said, "Go ask the bartender." And of course, they had the same bartender's guide. They'd look it up and they'd make one, you know? And so it was very much like that, a kind of totally stultified world in which very beautiful food could happen, but it wasn't much of a surprise to anyone who knew what was going on. Now this, into this world came a whole range especially the very later 60s and the early 70s when I happened to be at the New York Times, where I was during a tempestuous 2 years from 1971 to 1973. And what various things were happening. Some had already started during the Claiborne era, and he was very receptive to them. And that would be non-Cantonese Chinese food in restaurants outside Chinatown run by people who were not the descendants of Cantonese peasants who had worked on the American Railroad and were in the restaurants we grew up with serving a kind of restricted Chinese-American menu of no possible relation to food in the mainland since they had never even been there. So then all of a sudden the world changed, because the American immigration law changed in the 60s, and this meant that educated Chinese came to be students in America and never left, and one of them in particular started serving Sichuan food in a restaurant in Lower Manhattan that had been bankrolled by a Chinese-Brazilian shipping magnate named C.Y. Tung. And the Four C's was this place. It became modestly famous for having this highly seasoned food. And then that whole scene proliferated through into the 70s, and people got extremely fascinated by it. And I walked into the middle of that. And there, as a restaurant critic, you had the real problem of not having the slightest idea what to say about this stuff, because you'd never eaten it before. There were no reliable books. The people who were producing it didn't speak English or didn't care to explain them, so didn't even know what questions they should be answering or what questions you needed to ask them. So it was a kind of shadow boxing, but very interesting, because it was clear this food, even you know, with the kind of background one had, was very interesting food. And then there were other Chinese regions. Okay, so there was that. Then I persuaded the Times that I should go to France because after all, that's where the real action was in my field as a restaurant critic, and I was going to eat there. And I arrived on Palm Sunday of 1972, and I was immediately in a taxi accident on the way in from the airport. So I was somewhat shaken, and then I had dinner with a colleague's wife. The colleague had gone off to Ireland to cover violence in Belfast, and so this woman who was a really serious cook took me to a really traditional restaurant, and it seemed as though I'd never left. But then I had made a reservation in a restaurant, a three-star Michelin restaurant outside of Lyon, and run by someone called Paul Bocuse. And I knew enough to go there because when I had been a boy correspondent some years earlier, my boss had heard that there was this interesting young cook there. And he didn't know anything about him except that he had two stars and he had a kind of rising reputation. So I thought, I'll go there and see what's going on. So meanwhile, I had hired an old colleague who was a food-oriented photographer to work with me and take pictures. So we went on the train, and on the train, someone had abandoned a regional copy of the French news magazine L'Express, and Bocuse's picture was on the cover. You know, by a complete chance, I got to read a really sophisticated account about him and the other young chefs who this article said were revolutionizing French food, changing things, turning it upside down, and he was the leader. I thought, gosh, I'm a journalist, this is a big story, but it was a completely different kind of story because I was not talking about whether Bocuse's version of Blanquette de Veau was better than Fernand Poin's. I was having to face things that I had never heard of, that no one had ever served before. And there was a soup with a pastry crust over it and a whole truffle inside. So when you took the pastry out, you put your nose in there, you would get this amazing odor. It was a very original idea. And he served me this fish which also had puff pastry on it that had been decorated to look like a fish. And it came with a sauce which existed in textbooks, but no one had ever served it, to my knowledge. So it was all... everything was dramatic and exciting and new. And then my photographer, who was really plugged in, unlike the dragon lady I had had dinner with the night before, he really knew what was going on. And he said, you know, you really need to go to this little restaurant in an industrial suburb of Paris, Anières, run by someone called Michel Guérard. And it's called Le Pot-au-Feu, and maybe you'll get to go in because it's Holy Week, and the French are all going somewhere on vacation with their children. And indeed, I went and I had lunch there with Jack, and that was the real eye-opener. That was the, to my mind, the most original, revolutionary, radical restaurant of 30 years in either direction. It was just spectacular, and he later, he's had 3 stars in Michelin in this place he moved to in southwest France ever since, and he's now 87. And Bocuse is 89, I think. And they both are operating these restaurants, which are now absolutely, frozen in amber. What had been revolutionary is now so established and such a money machine that they're not making. Well, of course, they're in their late 80s, so fair enough. I don't expect to be doing radically interesting things then myself, even if I were able to now. But the point is that then, the most influential cuisine was in the process of being turned upside down. It later got called La Nouvelle Cuisine, and versions of it were translated into traditional cuisines everywhere, and they were all deconstructed and radicalized and opened up in various ways, which we could spend all day talking about, and which I do talk about at enormous, tedious length in this memoir that will be coming out next year about all of this. So, if you're thirsty for more information, just, survive till next May, and that should be your goal. So I write this article saying, the world is turned upside down here in France, and, no one really cared in New York because there was, you know, there was no place to eat it. It was a little hard to understand. And then Gerard did this stupid thing. He published a diet book called Cuisine Minceur. And so people, and since that became a bestseller for various reasons that you'll have to wait till May to find out about, in America, the whole nouvelle cuisine, which was not available in restaurants at that moment in the middle 70s, came to be seen as some kind of, you know, high fashion diet food. And that book is a total fraud. It's not diet food at all. It's just sort of slightly less militantly filled with calories and, you know, and oil and butter than a little more streamlined in presentation maybe than the food that people knew from fancy restaurants in France from previous trips. So the whole business was, and remains, completely confused, misunderstood. Meanwhile, it's going on, and the restaurant people all have figured this out. And they're doing that, and at the same time, American chefs, young people who graduate from cooking schools, of which there were basically two at that point, they managed to get themselves into French kitchens, and they really learn how to do it. They come back, and they become people like Thomas Keller, who then, you know, is equipped to do his own form of self-imagination, and the mood is on in the world that food is now going to be creative and new, and although mostly, when it's any good, grounded in French technique, people change the world, and the French, this the dead hand of French international style is pried loose, and there are barely any of those restaurants where the menu would be in the Gringoire and Saulnier and coded French without a translation, you know, and the waiters would really prefer to speak French to you, and that's all over with. You can't find a restaurant like that in America, I think, even if you try. So into the 80s and 90s, our world is turned upside down. So what kind of review do you write about food like that? Where you're not reviewing, it's not like a classical music critic going to a concert where the Beethoven Fifth is performed for the 19,000th time in the history of music, and where, you know, there are a limited number of things that you can say, but it's, you know, like too much bay leaf in the puree mongol. That's over with. Now you're presented with a landscape of aggressive novelty, and where your choices as a critic are also radically different. And I'm saying that my message here is that the way that food restaurant criticism evolved inevitably along with the great historical changes in food service itself that occurred from around 1967 until, you know, where we are now. And so if you're writing a restaurant review now, it just doesn't make sense anymore. The news that you're, or the food that you're talking about, the point of it is that it's different from other chefs' food, and that, or else it's copying some new dish that is in the grapevine. I mean, there's this butter poached lobster that Thomas Keller created, and it's our, you could find it on the internet in 11 different restaurants almost immediately. But that's like, you know, haute couture. Some Courage invents vinyl boots as a fashion item, and then you see them elsewhere, knocked off. So there's this atmosphere of novelty, fashion. I went for a magazine to France in the middle 70s, later 70s, and in every one of the restaurants I went to, it was asparagus season, and they all were serving little green asparagus tips in puff pastry in one way or another. The The one I liked best was a little puff pastry box with a lid ajar and the asparagus peeking out from inside it. But, you know, so it was a different world. I mean, you could actually do a review, you know, raffinée, kind of overly sophisticated review, comparing all these treatments of asparagus if you wanted to. But, I mean, it was not an illegitimate reaction to what you saw. So I dropped out of this world because I was so fortunate to be saved from constantly reviewing restaurants. And let me tell you, the real life of the restaurant critic was involved in things like meeting people when there were very few Vietnamese restaurants in America. One finally opened in the Midtown Manhattan, and I had these three friends meeting me. And it was a cold winter day, and it was on one of those blocks in Midtown where it was about a mile. The block was very long, and I approached this restaurant from the east, and the street was completely blocked by fire engines spraying, and this restaurant was on fire. we couldn't eat there, how was I going to find my friends? Because what if they were coming from the west? You couldn't even see them through the water and the smoke. And so I kept walking all the way around this block because you couldn't walk through it, and all the way around to the other side and then back again, freezing to death. And we finally met each other and went to some Indian restaurant in the neighborhood, which was actually very good and got reviewed in the New York Times as a result of this accident. But even more grotesque was some years later, there was a place called Vienna 79 because it was on 79th Street, and these people were not, you know, great geniuses running it, but they ran a pretty good restaurant, and it had already gotten wonderful reviews, so I was obliged to review it for somebody who I was working for, and I got there with three friends, and this little place, even to get into the bar a half hour early for your reservation was no help. And we were there for an hour and a half standing up, and they had set up a card table in the bar for, an actress who was there with her boyfriend. And so you were practically sitting on their table. It was so crowded. And in the middle of this insanity, there's an uproar from the actual dining room where there's a velvet rope. And this noise gets louder, and then you see that there is a man, unshaven, overweight, with a kind of Hawaiian shirt, and he's being carried by his hands and feet. He is prone, and he's screaming, and the two waiters are carrying him out and manage to maneuver him. He's writhing and through the bar, because he had no reservation, and he had just walked in there and demanded that they seat him. So they're carrying him out, and they get to the street, and they toss him out into the street. And on the way out, he grabbed the captain's telephone and ripped it out of the wall. And the entire audience in the bar waiting for their reservations applauded. So that's what it was really like to be a restaurant critic. I spent 20 years as the arts editor of the Wall Street Journal, and you know, I maintained a connection with that world, but I barely wrote about restaurants at all, and I was not unhappy to be out of that beat. But there came a time after retirement and my late in life return to the classics that I got summoned by the Wall Street Journal, which had a new section on Saturdays and was looking for a restaurant critic. So for 4 years, I had this very strenuous but interesting life, traveling a lot around America and somewhat in other countries, but mainly here, and discovering what an incredible new world there was of talented people in Des Moines, serving food that you would have been happy to eat anywhere, and in Milwaukee, and all over the place. In Boulder turned out to be a place you would really, and all of it was in this atmosphere of the chef as the creative artist. So I had those 4 years, and that included a connection with the real vanguard, people using lab machines and special chemicals to create things where the whole element of surprise was the point of it. I mean, there was the, to give you a small example, these people who now don't want to be called molecular gastronomers, which was a term that a physicist interested in food, I knew, coined to draw attention to a learned meeting of scientists and chefs in Corsica. Anyway, they want to be called modernist cooks, and there's my friend, Heston Blumenthal, who runs a very small, impossible to get into, 3-star Michelin restaurant near Heathrow Airport outside London. He has this dish, it's very famous, and it looks, well, you don't really know what it is, but let's say that it's a rectangle divided down the middle, and there are two squares. One is orange and one is purple. And it's a pâté of orange and beet. And so you figure, as you look at it, big deal, I'm waited 6 months to get this reservation, and I'm paying, you know, $300 a person to eat this lunch, and I'm getting a, you know, vegetable pâté, possibly solidified with gelatin. And why do I want this? And then you taste it, and you realize that the whole thing is this wonderful sight gag, because when you cook down the blood orange and the beets, they change color. And the beets become orange, and the blood orange, at least the, you know, the ones he has, turn a dark beet color. And so you realize, of course, that you're tasting beets when you taste the orange one, and you think this is the cleverest little thing that anyone ever did. And you get this thing, and they bring out an iPod Nano with earphones, and there's a kind of scene on the plate. There's sand and pebbles on one side and seafood on the other, and you're listening to the sound of waves crashing on the beach. So there's actually on the internet now a very learned academic article about the cuisine of surprise, and how long can this go on? And I have my doubts myself about, you know, that they have to completely reinvent the wheel every time they do this. So we may have come to the point where this kind of novelty, but you have to know what to say about it. And that's the job of the restaurant critic, and insofar as there will be restaurant critics, that's, in fact, that's what anyone now is doing, lots of the bloggers and just completely ad hoc reviews that are on the internet are the fact that there are so many of them objective descriptions of what, with pictures of things that people are eating, is, I think, a completely logical response to what's going on, because you really do want to know what it is that they're serving, and because you can't have any expectation from your previous experience as a diner the way you could have, even into the nouvelle cuisine up to a point, you know, you could kind of get it if someone said, well, it was a, you know, salmon cut across and then served with sorrel, you know, that at least was a comprehensible description of a dish, and it was like things you might have eaten, even though the ironic spirit of the nouvelle cuisine meant that the thing was called an escalope de saumon at Trois Gros, in the most successful restaurant menu meal of the mid-20th century. One of the things was this, an escalope de saumon was like an escalope de veau, like veal scallopini, because they cut the fish that way so that it was very thin, looked like except it was orange, but it looked like a veal, it was treated like a veal scallopini. And then it had this a sauce that one could go on. At any rate, if you really were attuned to what was going on, you would. If you were, certainly I couldn't have done it. It didn't occur to me till years later what it was all about. But if I had been reviewing that place, which I wasn't, and I had been able to say that, I would have been a very useful observer telling people about it. And the fact that it was brilliantly cooked was kind of an assumption that you made, you know? I mean, because it was this fabulous restaurant in which everything was perfectly done, and the taste and flavor of things was brought out by this method, which was not purely a kind of pun, and not at all. So it worked on so many levels, and that's what one could have said about that then. And if there was a place where they wanted reviews like that, which they still basically don't. So that's where we are now, where nobody wants to spend the kind of money that was spent on me for 4 years by the Wall Street Journal. And it was a lot of money because I was traveling constantly, and even though, and you know, eating in generally places they thought their audience wanted to eat in, and the world, the number of places I can tell you that the glossy food magazines are not covering expenses in the way that they used to, and that inevitably means that food criticism will ever more devolve into I don't want to call them amateur, but unpaid performances on the internet by people whose credentials are harder and harder to judge because anyone can play. Mm-hmm. So you can waste a lot of time on Yelp reading the latest account of someone who has gone to a place that people want to go to, and you have to kind of figure out whether you trust this person or whether you even want to read this kind of account. But anyway, it's a time that has, to some degree, real degree, is, if it hasn't drawn to a close, it really is drawing to a close. And so we're in an era of Top Chef improvisation and at the bottom, and then really brilliant things being done by small numbers of people in places that are very exciting to eat in if you have the tenacity to go after a reservation and want to spend that kind of money, but it trickles down. And so everything is better. That's my real message, that since 1965, when I first started eating in France, the world that we live in, the gastronomic world, the chain of supply, the ingredients available, the amount of information, the sophistication of chefs, the quality of their staffs, everything has improved to an enormous extent. I mean, when I first was writing about food in New York, it was a dismal scene. And there were two or three of these Soulet-style restaurants that were serving an embalmed cuisine, all modeled after one menu created by chance by Soulet in 1939. And there were some places in the theater district where you could get coq au vin in a truly abbreviated and uninteresting version. And it was like that. And and then everything began to get better. So you live in a better world than we did. I mean, there's much more going on. It's very exciting. The products are better. The bread is better. It's more universally available. Supermarkets are so much more sophisticated. You may hate organized agriculture, but when you go into a supermarket and you find the variety of product, and I mean serious product, I'm not talking about sugar-laden canned food and stuff that you don't want to eat. But there, you look around at the variety of things available now that you never ever could have found in the most lavishly supported neighborhood in Manhattan or L.A. Or now, the stuff you can find and the bread that's based on serious recipes that's baked on site from pre-proofed dough that they bring out, I mean, that I find in the semi-rural parts of New York. Anyway, for the moment, this is a better world. And really, I don't think that restaurant critics had very much to do with improving it. I think it was people who were determined to do better restaurants for people who knew more because they had traveled and read books and cooked themselves. So I feel that I was fortunate to be exposed to all this and got to write about it, but I think that there's not a real professional future for very many people anymore. So is that, I want to end on a positive note. I hope I have. But if you're wanting pre-professional advice, I think look elsewhere. Thank you. And I promise to do my best to answer your questions if you have any. Yes.
Who chose the restaurants that you reviewed?
I did, always.
You did?
Yeah. There was, excuse me.
I'm sorry, how did you hear about them?
Well, that's a really good question, because in the 70s, this whole dysfunctional world of mostly mediocre restaurants that I was supposed to be writing about, especially during, there was the central year of that time at the Times was when President Nixon created wage and price controls, which meant that it completely damped any, you know, kind of optional desire to invest in some high-risk thing like a restaurant. So they were just folding. The famous restaurants, you know, like the Chauvron, closed their doors, and the new places that opened were, by and large, you know, just not so good. At any rate, how did I find out about those? There was no internet, of course, and the public relations industry that fed on the restaurant world, it didn't occur to them that, I mean, I was the big game in town, you know, the New York, I mean, not me, but the New York Times, and I would get a trickle of press releases, and they were releases. There never was a menu. They never thought that it would be interesting to send you a menu so you could see what the place was really serving. They would do, you know, some adjectival fog of you know, semi-information, and so and I used to actually walk around to see what was opening. I would go on little hikes in likely neighborhoods where restaurants tended to be, just to see what was opening, because it was the only way I could find out, except some word of mouth from people I gradually met in the industry who would say, well, you might want to check out this place. But it was just completely hit or miss. And you know, I found also at that time that if I wanted to write about something that was interesting, I almost had to go re-review places that people already knew about, you know, that had been open for years, because there wasn't much you need to be a critic. You know, if you were a book critic, you have to have new books. You can't just review War and Peace all the time, you know? But in that world, there was not so much excitement. When I returned to this world, I mean, I was in it and out of it, but the most intense period, most recently, from 2006 to 2010, it was simply insane, you know? But the information was there. Every one of those restaurants, even before they opened, had a website. So you could download their menu. You could see what it was. There'd be pictures of the food in most cases. The names of the chefs were familiar because they'd worked somewhere else, and they were happy to tell you where they had worked. You could look at that restaurant, and you'd already eaten there, maybe. And meanwhile, there'd be, if you wanted to find, I mean, I decided I would make a trip through the Midwest to places that you wouldn't have ever thought when I, in 1970, would ever have a restaurant that had anything more than a steak. And Des Moines, I found three places of serious interest like that just by doing a search for restaurants in Des Moines and looking at their menus. And you know, after a while, you can tell a lot from a menu what is going to be there, and maybe they'll do a terrible job of it, but at least, you know, you see that it's a creative, interesting document, that there's someone who has a functioning brain in the kitchen. And so, I mean, it was simply amazing in the number of really fascinating places. And you could find, the other thing I found was they had me for a while doing, one kind of article I was doing was trends, and basically it was ingredients that were finding their way to menus now. And I just discovered that you could find anything you wanted on the internet. I mean, I went into one Italian restaurant in New York as somebody's guest, and they had pasta with snails in it. Something that had never occurred, you know, because my background was the snails would come in shells, inside little shells with a funny kind of tool with a spring action that you could pick the shell up and then with a little fork pull the snail out, and you know, as though it had really ever lived in that shell. And then there'd be this garlic, green garlic butter that you would eat with it. And that was basically what I knew. And now I see it's in pasta. Maybe other people are doing things with snails as a kind of a normal ingredient. And I looked up escargot and snails, and there were places all over America doing this, and they were almost all getting their snails from a supplier who was growing them in Texas. So you could do anything. You could find, because the scene was so explosive and with so many novelties and ingredients and people striving for the latest thing, that if you wanted to prove it, you could prove any trend you wanted, because it was happening somewhere. So the internet was extremely useful, and that changed everything. But also because there was a scene that it could be about. I mean, a realistic world instead of a fake world based on dead tradition, sometimes revived in a nice way, but usually just dead. Yes.
You talked about two of the food writers from the 60s, Craig Claiborne and Clementine Paddleford. I remember a third one, Pierre Frainie.
Well, I knew him. He was really a gifted chef. That was his training. And he had been a collaborator. Craig Claiborne had done a lot of things with him. They became friends. They had houses on the east end of Long Island, and and Pierre was a deeply informed. He had worked for Soule, and he and Jacques Pépin were both working at, I think, the Pavillon, and there was a strike in the kitchen, and led by these guys, and they lost their jobs, and for a while the two of them were working for Howard Johnson in the test kitchen that Howard Johnson has, trying to do serious French food frozen that could be sold in supermarkets. And the other chefs in their community kind of mocked them, and they called them les congélés. There are a few French majors here.
Yes,
congelé would just mean frozen food, you know. But also as two words, it's an unprintable term with frozen as the adjective. So, not that unprintable, but I'm not going to go try to translate that for you. So they were the frozen jerks, let's say. And Frenet never worked, neither of them actually ever worked in a restaurant again, and they made careers in the media. As you know, Pépin has written many books, and is a really important character, I think, in the world of food. Pierre was more senior, and he returned, he had a column in the Times later, and he worked with former colleague of mine called Richard Flast, and they did books together. But Pierre's English was not native, and so he always had a collaborator. And even when he signed things himself, I think that's true. But at any rate, he had wonderful recipes and good ideas. Sure, there were many other people they weren't necessarily restaurant critics. That's why I've been trying to confine this to that category. I mean, You could name James Beard or Mary Frances Kennedy Fisher or Julia Child, for example, and people would refer to all of them loosely as chefs, but they weren't, because they didn't work in restaurants, they would run kitchens, but they were important food writers, and there are at least a half a dozen many more who changed our food culture by doing wonderful cookbooks that opened up cuisines of places that no one had known much about before in a reliable way. So there's that. I could go on naming people, but I think you know who they are. Yes?
Did you
Did you ever have to go incognito?
I mostly did. Certainly when I was at the Times, I did, because they made such a fetish of it. Then, you know, 30 years, or, what, how many years later, 2006, 30 years later, I was convinced nobody knew who I was, you know. And every once in a while, it was such a bother because you couldn't remember what name you used, you know. and then there would be, you know, I didn't want to have a credit card in a false name and have yet another credit card account to pay. So I stopped doing that. And then, and it made it easier for people I was taking with me, because they would understand that they could use my name. The beauty of the other one was that because my name was known, but I was never using it, was when my father, I'm a junior, so when my father would come, I had the wonderful opportunity to say, "Dad, you can't make a New York reservation in your own name anymore, because they know how old I am, and they will treat you like a phony. As like an imposter if you use your own name." So, but later on I stopped, and every once in a while somebody would recognize me. I guess it wasn't perfect, and I probably should have continued not using my own name, but it just got to be too tedious. And by and large, they're not watching. I mean, except in the superheated New York restaurant scene where the Times critic is someone who makes or breaks their lives, or they think they do, then it's worth doing, but I don't really think and you know, it breaks down. When Ruth Reichel was at the Times, they knew who she was at Le Cirque. I mean, have you ever seen a picture of her?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, not everyone has that kind of hair. and I find it, you know, extremely seductive. Don't misunderstand. But it's hard to mistake, you know, someone who, even seen from behind, who is not, shall we say, a paragon of the art of coiffure. But has a lot of hair. So, I mean, it was clearly not. I mean, when she did that famous review of, you know, going in, not using her name and then using her name, and got treated very differently both times, well, anyone knew that was going to happen if you'd ever made a reservation in that place. And you suddenly realized there were two dining rooms, and one had Henry Kissinger and Pat Nixon in it, or, you know, or Nancy Reagan. And they were eating extraordinary food, and you were being treated in a very different way, shall we say. People, it was an open scandal. So the fact that it happened to her wasn't, they just collaborated in that with, I mean, it was somehow rigged. At any rate, it matters and it doesn't matter, and after a while, everyone knows what you look like anyway. I mean, I can't do that anymore. I mean, I know in places that matter, I know that, you know? And so, I couldn't function, not that I have the slightest desire ever to start doing that in New York again. God, you know. Then I got a letter when I started it, and I got that job, and I was 29, and Carter Burden, who had been a college classmate of mine, you know, this hereditary millionaire who was married to the daughter of Babe Paley, and they were in every magazine as this fabulous young couple, and they even had a carpet next to their bed with a big dollar sign on it. This was not a restrained young couple. And he wrote me a letter saying I had the job he'd always wanted. And, you know, couldn't really understand what, did he really want to have to only eat in places that happened to open that month? You know, when he could afford to go to Lutece every day, you know. I didn't get it. Anyhow, did I dodge your question?
No, you didn't.
Oh, okay, sorry. Anyway, I guess that's